This is the fifth chapter of Part 1, Literary Movements, Romanticism and Romantic Revival. Romanticism is a general but complex, unavoidable modern term applied to the deep change in European sensibility to art and creativity that occurs towards the end of the 18th century and dominates much of European culture in the first half of the 19th century. To define the term Romanticism is a Herculean effort because any attempt to unravel its complexity creates a perpetual rage in human mind. It connotes many things to many men. It becomes exceedingly difficult to render it concretely. It is like unchangeable taffeta or an opal, which keep on changing their colors and shades, unfolding definition after definition. This bewitching term envelops critics and scholars into confusion and perplexity and forces to face a brunt of it while analyzing, defining and interpreting. In fact, Romanticism has a bewildering variety of definitions and meanings. F. L. Lucas, in The Decline and Fall of Romantic Ideal, counts 11,396 definitions of Romanticism. To Goethe, G-O-E-T-H-E, Classicism is health and Romanticism is disease, while Stendhal is of opinion that all good art is romantic. Romanticism has been considered synonymous with attractive, unselfish, ornamental, unreal, realistic, irrational, materialistic, futile, heroic, mysterious, soulful, noteworthy, evolutionary, and other such terms. Rousseau defines it as the return to nature. Abercrombie, A-B-E-R-C-R-O-M-B-I-E, finds it the opposite not of classicism but realism, a withdrawal from outer experience to concentrate upon inner. W. P. Kerr considers it the fairy way of writing. Wyndham, W-Y-N-D-H-A-M, Lewis, views Romanticism as something disheveled, ethereal mystery, while T.S. Eliot condemns it as fragmentary, immature, and chaotic. Theodore, T-H-E-O-D-O-R-E, Watts Dunton's dictum about it is the renaissance of wonder and mystery. Pater considers it the addition of strangeness to beauty. To Heine and Beers, Romanticism is synonymous with medievalism. To my viewpoint, Romanticism can be linked to the passionate rebellion of an imaginative son against the rigid and strict discipline of his parents. Schlegel, S-C-H-L-E-G-E-L, who is usually responsible for introducing this into literary context, writes about 150 pages to explain the term but is unable to arrive at a single definitive meaning. The definition of romanticism continues to multiply without reaching any finality because it does not occur simultaneously in all European countries and varies with times, places, and authors. Therefore, it cannot be exactly defined, but its characteristics can be explained. However, despite such a welter of definitions, it is quite apparent that the cardinal points of Romanticism are emotion, imagination, freedom, individualism, and spontaneity. Historically, the term Romanticism is first introduced into the literary context by Schlegel. It is derived from romance. In England, the word romantic was at first connected with old romances, tales of chivalry, adventure and love, characterized by sentiment, improbability, exaggeration, unreality. In the 17th century, the Age of Reason, the word fell into disrepute, so that it became analogous to chimerical, bombastic, ridiculous, and childish. It is in the 18th century that the word again begins to recover status and acquire fresh meaning. The Romantic Revival. The Romantic Revival or Romantic Movement is a phase of English poetry which begins with the publication of the Lyrical Ballads, 1789, written by Wordsworth and Coleridge jointly, and ends with the death of Keats and Shelley. This movement is a hefty blow to the formalism, dry intellectuality, hard temper, discipline, and critical codification of the neoclassical poetry. The Romantics frown upon the mechanical, impersonal, artificial, and rational tradition of the Augustans, and delight in personal outpourings, human aspiration and imagination, and emotional directness. They cultivate an appeal for rapture, nostalgia for childhood and the past, the exotic and irrational realms of dream, leaving the choking atmosphere of hot coffee houses. They breathe in the open air and take us to the remote Middle Ages to introduce a world of wonder, a world of mystery, a world of beauty and curiosity, a world of strangeness, and a world of freedom and enthusiasm. The Romantic Movement is also called the Romantic Revival because the romantic traits and tendencies already exist in the Elizabethan literature and receive a setback during the 17th and the 18th centuries. Again, the spirit is wholeheartedly brought back into life by the 19th century poets. They not only try to resuscitate the Elizabethan temper and taste, but also plunge, through the help of the Elizabethans, into the worlds of medievalism and Hellenism, which are, from all points of view, conducive to the flowering of Romanticism. Thus, The Romantic Revival is three-dimensional, the Elizabethan Revival, the Medieval Revival, and the Hellenic Revival. Blake, Wordsworth, Coleridge, Sothe, and the Romantic poets of younger generation, Keats, Shelley, and Byron, they all draw inspiration from here to shape their romantic imagination, yet they are richly different from one another. Nevertheless, they all agree that a poet has a world of his own where personal experiences and feelings reign supremely. Characteristics of the Romantic poetry. The romantic conception of nature, place, and function of poetry is entirely different from that of neoclassical poetry. This new creed is launched by Wordsworth in his preface to the Lyrical Ballads, 1800, rejecting the matter, form, diction, and the style of the contemporary poetry. He tells that poetry is not a work of manipulation and labor, but a spontaneous overflow of powerful feelings, and it takes its origin from emotion recollected in tranquility. In the composition of poetry, there are two important stages, recollection and contemplation. He chooses his characters from rustic and humble life, whose feelings are more universal, permanent, and philosophical, and the matters are found in every subject which can interest human mind. Wordsworth perceives no difference between the language of poetry and that of prose, and his characters speak in a selection of language purged of human vanity and crookedness. Traditionally, the function of poetry was to instruct, but for Wordsworth, the function of poetry is to give pleasure, not chief pleasure, but exalted one. Thus, the romantic theory advocates for simplicity, spontaneity, and pleasure. In this regard, John Keats writes, "If it comes not as naturally as the leaves to a tree, it had better not come at all." Romantic poetry is of individualistic nature because the concept of man undergoes a change in the hands of the Romantics. Man now finds himself gifted with immense potentialities and huge possibilities of his self. He believes in the doctrine of the perfectibility of man, an organism, reacting against the Newtonian mechanical universe of science. With his boundless aspiration, the Romantics bring to a fuller consciousness of their own powers and set out in quest of the hidden realm of nature. Though sometimes they come back with the imperfect, yet it lends a grandeur to their targic quest. They are not a member of an organized, but a unique individual. Now, the poet is himself the subject and lays bare his heart with his thoughts and philosophies, whims and eccentricities. The glorification of the imagination is a paramount feature of romantic poetry. it is the highest faculty of the man, sorry, of the mind, and with this wonderful capacity, the romantics create beautiful imaginary worlds. They are idealists, mystics, spiritualists, and seers. Blessed with a peculiar insight, their emotional and intellectual desires are fully satisfied. To them, the imagination is a very source of spiritual energy, and through it, they uncover absolute truth and ultimate reality. For Blake, this world of imagination is the world of eternity. God and the imagination are one. That is, God is the creative and spiritual power in man, and apart from man, the idea of God has no meaning. It says emphatically, man is all imagination. God is man as exists in us and we in him. Imagination is the divine body in every man. Having a deep trust in the imagination, Coleridge gives a shape of life to this dead world. Creative activity is akin to God. Wordsworth infuses a life into every particle of nature through the power of his imagination. He helps to bring the soul of nature to man, and he himself is lifted out of himself to a higher state in which the soul of nature and the soul of man are united in a single harmony. Through this imaginative vision, Wordsworth attains an understanding of the oneness of things. That serene and blessed mood in which the affections gently lead us on until the breadth of his corporeal frame and even the motion of our human blood almost suspended as we are laid asleep in body and become a living soul. Shelley also calls poetry the expression of the imagination. Through it, he realizes the noblest powers. For him, the poet is a sheer gifted with a peculiar intuition into the nature of reality. And this reality is timeless, unchanging, complete order of which the familiar world is but a broken reflection. The one remains, the many change and pass, heaven's light forever shines, earth's shadows fly, life like a dome of many colored glass, stains the white radiance of eternity until death tramples it to fragments. Keats' imaginative world exists by an unending process of creation and makes man aware of the reality. He says, I am certain of nothing but the holiness of the heart's affection and the truth of imagination. Thus, the imagination for Blake, Wordsworth, Coleridge, Shelley, and Keats is colored with transcendental order. They believe not in logic, but in intuition, not in the analytical reason, but in the delighted, inspired soul, transcending both the mind and the emotion. They are not orthodox, but religious in their own way, accepting the holiness of reality. Blake's religion denies the existence of God apart from man. Shelley likes to be called an atheist. Keats is uncertain how to accept the doctrines of Christianity. That is why Wordsworth is called nature mystic, Coleridge supernatural mystic, Shelley love mystic. This is a continuation of the chapter Romanticism and a Romantic Revival. That is why Wordsworth is called nature mystic, Coleridge supernatural mystic, Shelley love mystic, and Keats beauty mystic. The Romantics are not interpreters but creators, so their poetry is suggestive and symbolic. For Blake, every living thing is a symbol of everlasting powers, and it is these which he wishes to grasp and understand. In Wordsworth's poetry, the shepherds, dalesmen, and beggars, the daisy, cuckoo, the flower, and the grass, we tread underfoot the humblest word, they all acquire an eternal significance. The common things in nature and human are not common and trivial. They are symbols of eternity. Shelley's nature objects are also symbolic. In Adonais, A-D-O-N-A-I-S, he employs pansies and violet as the symbols of the fate of his poetry and the innocence of his life. Objects of nature, like sky, stars, moon, sun, wind, and stream, are represented by the poet as symbols of eternity. The cloud is a symbol of the poet's own suggestive consciousness. In the west wind, he finds the symbol of the destroyer and creator. His skylark stands for the spirit of joy. The essence of Keats' poetry is that in catching the fleeting movement of joy, it opens the doors to an eternal world. He does two things at once. He addresses the individual living nightingale, but passes beyond it to an ideal bird, which is the symbol of eternal music, perfection, and immortality. The neoclassists live in the present and reflect contemporary society. While the Romantics are dissatisfied with the ugliness, miseries, and wretchedness of the mundane world and seek the remote, the distant, and the unfamiliar world to placate their anguished souls, Coleridge and Keats escape into the world of medievalism, where they meet slim damsel, chivalrous knight, and colorful pageantry. If Coleridge retreats in the dream world of his own, Keats either sits in the Elizabethan tavern or roams in the Hellenic world, where he gets enamored by the charming gods and goddesses, pulsating with the energy and passions and pangs of human being. Shelley rarely lives on this earth. He fixes his gaze at the golden future and builds an ideal world free from inequality, tortures, and tears. His firm optimism burst out in the following line: if winter comes, can spring be far behind? Steeped in the spirit of democracy and humanitarianism, the Romantics raise a voice against tyranny, brutality, and injustice, and fight tooth and nail for the amelioration of the downtrodden and underdogs of the society. They have a sympathy for the common people, shepherds, cottagers, peasants, reapers, gleaners, leech gatherers, beggars, and reject the gallant lords and gay butterflies of fashion. They are the champions of freedom, freedom of the body, freedom of the mind, and freedom of the soul, and uphold the ways of primitive age where man was wandering freely on the breast of nature, unaware of rules and regulations, government laws and social restrictions imposed on him. Save Keats, Blake, Coleridge, Wordsworth, Southey and Shelley, all are deeply influenced by the French Revolution and the French philosophers, particularly by Rousseau. With a spirit of defiance, they revolt against the existing systems, social, religious, political, economic, and literary, heralding a new age of liberty, equality, and fraternity. That is why Victor Hugo describes Romantic movement as liberalism in literature. In Address to the Irish People, Shelley emanates his anger at the people who bear tyranny. Does not your heart bound at the bare possibility of your posterity possessing liberty and happiness? Oh, if your hearts do not vibrate at such as this, then ye are dead and cold, ye are not men. The neoclassical poetry is essentially a poetry of town life, dealing with clubs and coffee houses, drawing rooms and social and political life of London. The Romantics shift their attention from urban life to countryside and paints nature picturesquely in all its moods, phases and colors, from the tranquility of the cool, breezy and splendid sunset to the tempestuously of the west wind tearing the breast of the Mediterranean and creating a chasm into it. An inseparable part of their poetry, nature is a perennial fount of joy and love and inspiration and beauty. Their poetry is alive with hills, mountains, forests, lakes, waterfalls, rivers, meadows, golden sunshine, purple noon, rosy evening, full-blown moon, twinkling starry sky, various types of flowers and birds, and protean natural phenomena. However, the Romantics are not only content with the pictorial physical portrayal of nature, but are penetrated with intellectual, spiritual, fantastic and mystical experiences. But it is to be noted that each Romantic poet has his distinct subjective outlook towards nature. Wordsworth's incipient passionate love for nature, for the sake of angling, snaring bird, hunting and enjoying scenes and sights, turns into a sweet sensation. The sounding cataract haunted me like a passion, the tall rocks, the mountain and the deep and gloomy wood, their colors and their forms were to me an appetite, a feeling and a love. And finally, nature becomes to him a great teacher, nurse, mother, guide, guardian, healing power and a treasure of happiness, acquiring intellectual, spiritual and mystical character. Coleridge, more sensitive, delicate and keen than Wordsworth, fails to perceive any spiritual communion in nature, though his early nature poetry bears the mark of the Wordsworthian philosophy. To him, there is no external agency to render support and consolation in misery. He looks at nature to seek subjective thoughts and feelings. The natural objects water, sky, earth, fire, air, moon and sun, all shimmering in elusive lights, colors and shades, are the symbolic of emotional as well as psychic states. In dejection, he explains that nature lives only in us and that it is we who create all that matters in her. Shelley's nature, peopled with spirits, is full of life, movement, and energy, glistening with mist, vapor, clouds, and lights. His nature imagery, abstract, hazy, indefinite, is symbolic of his visionary glory. His treatment of nature is scientific and pantheistic. Shelley identifies himself with her power and bursting energy. Make me die, liar, even as the forest is. What if my leaves are falling like its own? The tumult of thy mighty harmonies. Keats' approach towards nature is entirely different from Wordsworth or Shelley. Nature is a source of joy forever, which feeds his senses. He records all the aspects of nature through sensuousness. Compton Rickett observes the color, the scent, the touch, the pulsing music. These are the things that steer him to his death. There is not a mood of the earth he does not love, and a season that will not cheer and inspire him. The spirit of supernaturalism never fails to fascinate the romantics. Theirs is a world of wonder and witchery, mystery and macabre, teemed with fairies, ghosts, demons, witches, ruins, graves, unknown places, distant lands, old castle shrouded in silence, and misty jungle covered with jaggy trees. They weave a fabric of airy night, awe-inspiring stillness, dreamliness, loneliness, superstition, and suspense. Coleridge's wonderful genius flowering into the lovely treatment of supernaturalism renders it in a purely poetic way. He states about his poetry that the incidents and agents were to be, in past, at least supernatural. To him, supernaturalism is a phenomena of the mind, and he liberates it from crude and horrid sensationalism, gruesome and terrifying machinery by introducing refinement, tantalizing suggestiveness, and human touches. Coleridge's superb handling of supernaturalism is shown in Kubla Khan, Kristen Bell, and Rime of the Ancient Mariner. Of them, Kubla Khan is a fine fruit of supernaturalism. In it, the sweetheart is weeping and waiting for their demon lover under the waning moon. Coleridge's supernaturalism is not only a physic phenomena, but also a symbol of the mystery of life and a symbol of love which encompasses man and bird and beast and life of all creation. So, it is realistic, convincing, obsessing, and widespread. Similarly, Wordsworth also casts an aura of unearthliness on his common characteristics and situations and events. In his Solitary Reaper, the reaper all alone gathering corns in a deep valley is singing an enchanting song which captures the attention of the poet. He gets spellbound, though he fails to understand the language of music. It seems that she does not belong to this mundane world, but a creature of the other world. John Keats is not far behind Wordsworth or Coleridge in the use of supernaturalism in Lamia and the Bale, Damn Sends Mercy. In Ode to a Nightingale, the portrait of a princess imprisoned by a wizard in a world castle located in a fairyland, standing at the casement operated by magical power and opening to a perilous, vast, foamy ocean, impinges an ineffaceable imprint on the mind. Thus, supernaturalism is a texture of romantic poetry. An echo of pessimism vibrates in the works of the romantic poets. Their bosoms are filled with pains. They pour out their miseries, frustration, anxieties, troubles, and turmoils without any reservation. The melancholy is occasioned by the transience of human life, fragility of beauty, uncertainty of death, unrequited love, and the effete social tradition sapping the vitality and dignity of man. In Youth and Age, Coleridge laments the loss of his physical strength, mental vigor, poetic fervor, and the rupture of friendship. He fills his life, like some poor knight-related quest that may not rudely be dismissed, yet hath outstayed his welcome while, and tells the jest without the smile. Shelley is also prostrated with an abysmal grief and disappointment. In stanzas written in dejection near Naples, bereft of hope and health, fame and power, love and leisure, his tragic intensity is more aggravated as he looks his look over his fellow being. Smiling they leave and call life pleasure. To me that cup has been dealt in another measure. His condition is like a dying lamp, a falling shower, a breaking billow, and a phantom among men, companionless as the last cloud of an expiring storm whose thunder is its knell. Burdened with the miseries of life, his heart is torn asunder, and like a wounded child, he looks at others with a sob for mercy. Oh, lift me as a wave, a leaf, a cloud. I fall upon the thorns of life. I bleed. Shelley ponders over the futility of life and discovers that the sincerest laughter of man is filled with pain because we decay like corpses in a charnel, fear and grief convulse us and consume us day by day, and cold hopes swarm like worms within our living clay. Keats' Ode to a Nightingale is a cry of his soul. Dissatisfied with the crushing realities of life, he wishes to escape to the land of imagination as he considers this world a vale of tears. Here, man is always surrounded by sufferings and sorrows. Here, youth gets withered in the prime of his life, and beauty is ephemeral. Where but to think is to be full of sorrow and leaden-eyed despair. Both Keats and Shelley frequently long for death, an easeful death, the former in the land of the nightingale while listening to the sweet song, whereas the latter wishes that I could lie down like a tired child and weep away the life of care which I have borne and yet much bear till death like sleep might steal on me. They do so because both are conscious of the spell of melancholy which brings sweet and chastening effect on the mind. Shelley discovers his sweetest songs in his saddest thought. Wordsworth, who is supposed to be least despondent, also becomes sombre and hears a sad music of humanity in his declining age. In this connection, Victor Hugo is quite apt in his remark, "Melancholy is the distinguishing mark of romantic art." Romantic poetry is marked by lyricism and music. Compared to the Augustans, the Romantics are daring and various in their versification and poetic genres. They return to the study of Chaucer and the great Elizabethans and to Milton, who were a source of inspiration to them. Denouncing the heroic couplet, the Romantic poets revive a number of old meters and poetic forms. The Spenserian stanza, the ballad meter, the blank verse, the lyric, the ode, the sonnet, the pastoral elegy are all revived and soon attain wide popularity. Thus, English Romanticism is both a revolt and a revival. It is a revolt against the 18th century tradition and convention. It is a revival of old English meters and old English masters of poetry. Thus, this chapter is now over.